Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Sally Portnoy, an innovative interdisciplinary artist working in glass, clay, bronze, cement, polyurethane, mosaic, and steel. Her designs have been exhibited in numerous solo and group exhibitions in Australia, the US, and Canada, and have earned her wide recognition and representation internationally in private and permanent collections. Her work has also been exhibited at the annual Chicago Sculpture Objects Functional Art and Design Fair, dedicated to three-dimensional art and design presented by national and international galleries. Sally grew up in Winnipeg and studied ceramics at the University of Manitoba, the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. She did her BA in Fine Arts and Masters of Studio Art in Sydney, Australia, and has done numerous workshops and courses with leading ceramicists of Canada, the US, and Australia. She has been living in Australia for many years and has been in community projects, as well as taught many weekend workshops and summer art classes. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, hi.
When you describe your art practice on your website, you write that your creative inspiration is a mystery to you. Can you elaborate on what may spark your ideas by describing some of your works?
Sure. When I say it's mystery to me, it's that I don't start out with a totally clear concept and then work to that. My concept and my understanding of what I'm doing evolve as my work is evolving in front of me in three dimensions. So often I'll even start out with just inspiration from the materials, especially glass. It's such a seductive and tantalizing material as it transmits light. I'll often think, oh, that would look great in glass. And I'll start making something and I'll realize it has continuity with what I've made in the past, and that my subconscious is basically coming out in 3D in front of me and feeding back to me stories and important things that are important to me. I'm also very influenced by nature, because that's just the best designs out there. And so, yeah, I guess that's what I'm talking about when I'm saying that. It's a mystery to me in that, why did I choose to do that, not this? Or even when I'm looking at other artwork, why does this appeal to me and not that? I know materials and form have a lot of impact on me, but a lot of it's mystery.
And how does your traveling add to that mystery and influence to inspire some of your work?
Well, I think firstly, it allows me to know myself outside of my comfort zone. And especially when I'm in a country that is culturally very different than where I grew up, I get different feedback of who I am, because people aren't relating to me coming from a certain family or a certain place or having a certain occupation. They're relating to me just from my pure energy. So I think it takes you out of your comfort zone. Traveling and wakes you up, the way I travel anyway. And I just see a lot more when I travel. When I came back from Turkey, I used to do some semi-production work and would come up with different designs every year and then explore that. So when I came back from Turkey one year, I made very heavy gold fused pieces that, you know, remind me of the glitz of Turkey. So I just see more and I get influenced by more when I travel.
And what's involved in the process of your ideas?
Mostly I just jump in. I don't do fused work anymore. I'm mostly making figurative or semi-figurative solid cast works. I just stick my hands in the clay and start, usually. I'm always thinking of the mechanics of how I can realize the piece, like how it will be fired, what will actually work, because glass can be pretty tricky. So it's a combination of, you know, the physicality of the material and my ideas, but mostly what in my practice now, I'll make something solid in clay, cover it with a plaster silica material to make a mold, pull out the clay, and place cold glass in the mold and fire that. That's basically it. I often, as well, if I have particular projects, we'll start with hot glass rather than cold glass, and I'll hire somebody to help me pull it out of the furnace and drop it into molds. So it depends what I'm doing. Sometimes I'm working in bronze and then I'll make waxes. But basically I start with my hands in the material and just go.
I interviewed a contemporary of yours a couple of weeks ago, Alan Lakovitsky, and you had some similar training together, yet you really took different directions in your art practices. Can you tell us about your training experience and where it led you?
Sure. Well, I started out at University of Manitoba studying with much inspiration from Alan, with Robert Archambault and ceramics. But I had already lived in Australia and missed the ocean. So when Walter Ostrom came to as a visiting artist to U of M, he inspired us to go to NASCAD in Halifax, which was a fantastic opportunity. Alan finished his degree there with John Reeve, and we both were the studio assistants and worked very closely with him. And I got very fond of the Leach tradition and making pots. And then we came back to Australia and set up a pottery, two potteries, actually, one in South Australia, firing it with sump oil, and the other in Sydney. But how did I get into glass? One summer I was back in Winnipeg. I came back to Winnipeg almost every summer. But this one summer I was staying for a couple months and rented a studio at Warren Carter's studio on Roslyn Road, rented some studio space and put together a ceramic exhibition. And he was a glass artist, is a glass artist. And though we work very differently with the material, he took me on a road trip of his past around California where he studied. And I was introduced to this material that glazed itself. So I was very excited about that. I had started making some ceramic earrings just because I wanted a pair to match a dress I made and painted them up and glazed them. And I saw this material that glazed itself. So that excited me. And I started fusing bits of glass. I ended up painting gold on them. Then I guess the pieces of jewelry just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I was really seduced by the material of glass. And I think at the time, too, it was somewhat influenced by the fact that I could probably make a better living with glass. But I've not given up my love of clay. My models are still mostly made in clay. And a couple of years ago, I had the chance to throw some pots at Alan's studio and realized I still love doing this and have the intention of going back to making some pots as well.
Have you exhibited in many places in Australia and Canada? Where else have you been exhibiting?
Mostly Australia now. I got a bit disillusioned with international galleries, how they treated the artists and how they treated the artwork and the expense of sending work over. So really, at the moment, I'm mostly doing group exhibitions. I had a solo show just over a year ago in Australia, but now I am working on larger pieces and just doing group exhibitions. I have one piece at the WAG, at the gift shop, until they renovate the middle of January. It was a model for the public artwork I did at the Rady Center. So it's three dancing gals on a sandstone pedestal, and the piece there is ceramics, glass, and bronze cast, which was too expensive to do outside of the Rady Center, but the form is quite similar. And I also have work at the Warehouse Arts Gallery in, I think it's McDermott Street in Winnipeg, but I don't really have any plans of any international exhibitions at the moment, though you never know what's around the corner.
But when you did go to Chicago and you were at the SOFA, yes, what was that experience like?
Well, it was fabulous seeing what else was out there and having my work displayed in such a prestigious place with, you know, a gamut of artists of all different mediums. It's a lot of work and a lot of expense, though, and in many ways, there's a couple big galleries making money and the people renting the spaces. Otherwise, it's not that fruitful for artists, but it's still worth the experience. So I enjoyed it when it happened, and I think I did it 2 or 3 years. And you gain exposure a lot that way, but now with the internet, it's not as useful.
Looking at your photos online when you're teaching, it looks like you're having a lot of fun, and you seem to have an interesting, innovative teaching technique of taking your students through the process of starting with blowing glass bubbles to blowing glass forms to casting. Can you elaborate on how you like to teach your workshops and some of the workshops you've done?
Well, mostly I teach glass casting, and I teach open molds, which are very simple, so that has a lot of limitations, and I find it interesting to have those limitations and work around them. most of the time the students are spending being creative and doing rather than getting bogged down in the process. I teach glass blowing in my studio just once a year as part of the Manly Arts Festival, where I hire a glass blower. I'm not a glass blower myself, so he teaches kids, gives them the experience of blowing a bubble or teaches people how to make a simple vase. It's really just whetting their appetite for an experience that they might take further or not. In my classes, I'm specialized in two-day classes where I just throw all the information at people and it gives them something to go further with if they choose. When I teach internationally, mostly they are two-week classes and then there's more time to explore ideas, not just the process. But yes, I get very inspired by inspiring others and seeing what direction people take because everybody's so different.
Does it give you ideas for your own work as well?
Probably somewhat. I think mostly I give them ideas. A lot of students copy their teacher's work, and as I did it when I was a potter, for a place to start.
And can you tell us a little bit about the Manly Arts Festival?
Well, the Manly Arts Festival is a once-a-year festival that's a pretty dynamic festival of all sorts of types of artwork and theater. And in my studio, we open it up for kids come in and they blow a bubble till it bursts, which is lots of fun. And my assistant is very patient and really great with kids, so that's been really fun. And people also have a chance to make a vase. And then there are more intense two-day workshops that come after that, where people really learn the skill of glass blowing. It's just the beginning. It's like throwing pots. Some people take to it very quickly, and other people take a long time to center and to get the mechanics of it moving. But it's an inspiration to see so much energy, and it's also a bit scary because I have like 100 kilos of glass at 1,100 degrees centigrade sitting in my garage at the time. So every year I think, oh, will I do it again? But and glass studios with hot furnaces mostly have closed down. It's a dying art because it's so expensive to run.
You also mentioned some international workshops that you do. Can you tell us about the one that you did at the Glass Furnace in Istanbul?
Well, I haven't done that for a long time because it keeps getting cancelled.
Oh.
So that's really sad because of their political situation. They're struggling, but it's a fantastic setup, and I encourage anybody to get there that can. And Turkey is such an inspiration in itself. It's just, you know, things get thrown at you constantly, and the vibrancy of the place is very inspiring. But the setup there is they've got a fantastic facility, and I've gone in and taught just plain glass casting. Whereas when I went to Kilchuk, I went with my son, and we taught glass casting and slug casting, which he would take balls of hot glass from the furnace and drop them in molds. And I do that in my studio as well with assistance from somebody who can carry heavy amounts of hot glass on the end of a stick. So, yeah, and so sometimes we work with Team Portnoy. We've been doing mosaic projects together locally as well, so that's been a lot of fun.
Is there anything you'd advise young artists as they start out on their careers or become more established?
I'd advise them not to get rid of their day job. It's not an easy thing. I mean, I started out as a potter thinking, okay, if I make objects, that's much easier than selling paintings. Well, I was wrong there. But I advise anybody to have the courage to follow their own truth and to just keep on making. You get better as you keep on making and looking. Look at form, look at things that you like, notice what you like, and try not to be too influenced by getting into exhibitions because you get a lot of rejections no matter who you are, and a lot of it is the luck of the draw and believe in themselves, really.
I would like to thank you so much for taking the time to share your story, your perspective and advice with our audience today. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
That was sculptor and former Winnipegger Sally Portnoy speaking with us from Australia. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is Ryan Mayberry, founder of Art Moi, an initiative to simplify the process of documenting art. ArtMoi is a creation registry platform that provides professional artists, collectors, and galleries with tools to catalog, organize, track, and share provenance-based information on a work of art or collectible object over time. The ArtMoi platform provides a foundation for the adoption of new technology and enables artists and creators to participate in how their work is managed and used. ArtMoi has recently gained institutional support from Western University, the Art Gallery of Ontario, and the Art Canada Institute, where they are collaborating to establish a standard program for building digital catalog raisons for some of Canada's most celebrated artists. ArtMoi has recently adopted a pay-what-you-can pricing model, a unique approach known as the Patreon model for funding creative individuals. Through Ryan's two passions, art and technology, he and the company strive to fulfill ArtMoi's mission, to empower artists and make art more accessible to everyone. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to be talking to you.
Can you tell us about your passion for art and technology and how they have led to the founding of ArtMoi?
I think I come by both those passions quite organically. I grew up in an art gallery. My father started his first gallery back in the 1970s, so I've grown up in that environment, surrounded by art, surrounded by artists, and just generally being exposed to it on a day-by-day basis. I've also just always been kind of a nerd, so I taught myself how to program computers when I was a little kid in the 80s, and it's just something I always sort of stuck with as a hobby as a kid, and that eventually turned into work, and I started my first sort of professional jobs was as a computer programmer in a variety of industries outside of the art world, and eventually I was able to just kind of merge the two, art being something that I'm passionate about and software engineering and coding and development just being something that I enjoy doing.
You were also fortunate to have been a speaker at the TEDx in Winnipeg a year ago, and you spoke of ArtMoi's philosophy. Can you elaborate on that for us?
We view ourselves as a very creator-centric organization, something that I kind of learned just being part of the art world and working in galleries and working with auction houses and especially dealing with historical art and secondary market art. So as opposed to contemporary work coming straight from an artist, working with artwork that comes out of an estate or things that people have inherited or were gifted or just, you know, kind of found in flea markets. And something that I sort of noticed early on is that details, historical accounts, the provenance behind a work of art, even just, you know, dates of when works were created, that type of information was very hard to find. Typically, the person who was in possession of a painting didn't know the whole story behind it, and the ability to kind of research it was kind of lost. And having grown up in that environment and knowing a lot of artists in their lifetime as they were actively producing, I knew that, you know, artists were the best source of information about their own artwork, but the stories and the information and the knowledge that they have was never getting captured, because the process of documenting a work of art typically doesn't happen until late into an artist's career, and often after they've already passed away. So the ability to get authoritative information is difficult because the primary source of that authoritative information is no longer around. So our philosophy, being artist-centric, means to give artists the tools and the capability to capture those stories and capture that provenance in their lifetime and do it in a way that's kind of organic and just ties in with their own productivity needs and their own just the day-to-day needs that an artist has in managing their own career. So we want to help them be successful artists, but at the same time allow them to generate an official record of provenance around their work while they do that. And it's something that is kind of absent from the art world. Most technology tools tools and productivity tools or tech-based tools that are developed for the art world are typically developed for large art galleries, large museums, large auction houses, and not for the individual artist, which, in my opinion, just seems a little counterproductive because the artist is the start of the supply chain. And that is the point where you need to capture authoritative and authentic information about a work of art.
So are you moving towards advancing a standardized means of artwork identification?
Yeah, we are working with organizations like the Art Canada Institute, the Arts and Humanitarians Department at Western University, to determine what the best practices are for gathering provenance, storing provenance, verifying that information, and making sure that it is accessible and usable from a technology standpoint, not just now, but as technology evolves. So Western University just started this September a course in digital futures of the art world that was put together in collaboration with ourselves and the Art Canada Institute. So they have humanitarians and fine arts students that are studying these best practices and doing a practicum in the process of compiling official catalog resumes on some celebrated Canadian artists. And our hopes is, you know, with that program and that syllabus, it's something that we can share and make available to other schools and other organizations. There needs to be a standardization in what type of information is gathered and how it's gathered and how it's verified. And then we ourselves at ArtMoi are trying to establish a technology standard of how artwork information is communicated from one computer system to another computer system, and how the data can be communicated, secured, and verified digitally as well.
Just for a little clarification, can you explain what a catalog raisonné is?
Yeah, sure. So catalog raisonné is basically a chronology of an artist's body of work. So it typically lists every single piece of art that an artist has created, or at least the hope is that you get every single piece of art that an artist has created, and catalogs images, details about that work of art, physical details, just size, medium, that type of thing, but also details of where it was exhibited, when it's been exhibited, if it was ever part of important collections, maybe it was illustrated in a book, all the history and events that an individual painting can go through. So that catalog becomes a extremely valuable resource for all different players in the art world. An appraiser will use a catalog raisonné to help verify and authenticate a work of art. A curator at a museum will use information from a catalog raisonné to help determine the importance of a work of art or where a single painting fits within a body of work. So it's essentially just the, you know, a complete history of what a single artist has done or produced. It's essentially, you know, after an artist has completed a lifetime of work, the catalog is their legacy. It is, you know, the chronology of everything that they've left behind.
And you've also begun to use a pay-what-you-can model. Can you tell us a little bit more about this company and your collaboration with their model?
Sure. So artists, individual collectors, galleries, anybody that has a use for ArtMoi can access our system under a pay-what-you-can model, which means they can pay us whatever they want to pay us, starting from $0 all the way up to however much they want to give us. We've adopted this model through another online platform called Patreon. Patreon allows any creative individual to sell their work or get support for what they do through just general patronage, something that's kind of been in the art world for for hundreds and hundreds of years. Some of the most famous works of art were produced because of patrons, because of people who want to enable an artist to do great things, so they support them financially so that they have the ability and the time to create freely. We view ourselves at Art Moi as artists. We don't paint pictures or sculpt things, but we write code and we develop platforms, and for us there's a similar process for how we build what we build and how an artist builds what they build. So the pay what you can model and the general concept of patronage, I think, works really well for us because it enables artists at any stage of their career to access the full breadth of features and functionality and technology that we can provide. Artists don't have the luxury typically of a steady income. Their cash flow ebbs and flows on a daily or weekly basis, and it often ebbs more than it flows. They don't have the means often to invest heavily into technology, and yet they still need to protect their legacy and their copyright and interest in everything they create from day one. They need that protection right when they start their career. They don't just need it when they become successful and can afford a database to log things in, or afford to make a website, or afford to produce legal contracts for their work and those types of things. They need it from day one. So the pay what you can model allows them to access all the technology tools that we can provide, and they can pay us when they have the ability to do so. And that model or that philosophy, I think, lends itself very well to the natural instincts of an artist and natural motivation of an artist, and we found that it works extremely well for what we do. We have a lot of artists that can't pay us anything but support us through social media and word of mouth, and will pay us whenever they can. We have some people who pay us and support us with hundreds of dollars a month who don't really need a lot of access to our tools, but they see the value in what we do and want other people to be able to access it as well. So it's certainly a different business model, especially in the software world, but given that we're really kind of focused on a specific niche and a user that has quite unique needs and capabilities, it works really well for us.
Well, we're just running out of time, so I'd like to thank you very much for speaking with us today and sharing your story and the exciting developments of Art Moi. I wish you continued success.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was Ryan Mayberry, founder of Art Moi, an initiative to simplify the process of documenting art. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.